Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You're very welcome to Liveline. 0874848888 for your WhatsApps, 51551 for your texts. Alison Hanrahan, good afternoon to you.
Hi, good afternoon to you.
Will we start with the note on the windscreen?
Oh, well, I am a disabled badge holder and I have found that I've had several different experiences over the years of having a disabled badge. I have come back to my car with a note left on it asking me who the cripple is. I've had situations where I've had people screaming at me when I'm trying to park the car. And I've also seen another lady beside me who had a child in the back seat of the car. And people have gone up to her this particular occasion and said, who's the cripple?
No.
And she had to go back to the back of her car and take out a wheelchair for her child. So it is abusive situations I have been encountering whilst holding a disabled badge.
And your own story is you were diagnosed with multiple sclerosis 21 years ago. That's why you hold the badge you hold.
Well, I was diagnosed in 1994 and I had relapsing remitting at that stage. And I applied for it maybe 10, 12 years into it because when I'm relapsing, I'm bedbound, more or less. And when I am remitting, I can go around and I don't need the use of my disabled badge. But about 2.5 years ago, I moved into the next stage. So it's called secondary progressive. Okay. So now I have to use a stick or a wheelchair.
And obviously you need to be as near as possible to the door of a shop or whatever service it is you're using.
Yeah, I mean, and that's why disabled spaces are put so near doors and stuff. It's to allow access to people that want to get out of their house. They don't want to stay housebound. They want to try and continue to live life as normally as possible.
And there are occasions when you exit your car, as you say, where the immediate disability is not apparent to people, and people who may think they're fulfilling their civic duty challenge you.
Yes, they do. And I mean, I have said over the years to my children, I just wish that people could see if my nose turned red or my nose turned green or something was obvious. Not all people who have a disabled badge have obvious ailments. I mean, you only get a badge for 2 years and every 2 years you have to reapply for it again. And that requires your GP to sign a form or even your consultant to confirm that nothing has changed or that you've moved into another stage.
Now, I suppose, seeing as I opened with the question, there was a note left on your windscreen. What did it say?
Well, I was asked who the cripple was, but I think what I wrote to you directly about is I was so upset coming out of a private car park the other day where there were two disabled spaces. One, a man had just driven into, and he was getting out of his car. And as I was trying to get to the second disabled space where my car was parked with the disabled badge on it, I just said to him, you know, that's a disabled space. And he went, yep. And I said, well, if you have a disabled pass, you should put it on your screen so people can see. Mm. And he went, nope. And I said, well, are you going to move? Because it is a disabled space. And he went, nope. And I just went, well, shame on you. And he came around and deliberately looked to see whether I had a pass or not. I could do nothing. Private car park. Who do I go to?
Well, I mean, you might explain that in a public disabled parking space, Gardaí or traffic wardens can find someone for parking in it. But it's in a private parking space, and you might tell me if I'm right here, it's up to the owner of the car park to enforce that, but there's no legal obligation on them to do so.
Correct. There's nothing. Your hands are tied. You can do nothing. And I don't want to waste the guard's time, but equally I want it to be known. It's so frustrating. People go in and they park in the space and they think, oh, it'll only be 10 or 15 minutes. But in those 10 or 15 minutes, there could be someone with a disabled pass who want to use that space, who need to use that space to make access available for them. They don't want to have to go and drive around again and again in the hope that there will be a free one.
I mean, and you come from the perspective, obviously, where you know what it's like to be challenged about not having a disability when you do have a disability. So I presume, bearing all that in mind, when you challenged the person who was parked in the disabled parking space, in the back of your mind, you harboured the possibility, at least, that here was a person in a similar person. Well, did you think that it might be someone in a similar circumstance who didn't, you know, who didn't have an obvious disability, but who may have been entitled to have a pass? Or did you presume that they weren't entitled to it?
Sorry, apologies.
Not at all. No, it's a conversation a lot of people want to get in on today. We can't blame the dog for wanting to pitch in too.
I know. Well, I just feel if people have a disabled badge, they're going to use it to park in the nearest spot that's going to be available to them, to the door or access to where they're going to. So if someone doesn't have one, I just said to this man in particular, you need to put on your car. But because the private car park, you know, I have no one to go to, and they don't have to. You, by law, have to put a disabled badge on your car if you're parked in a disabled space. It's not a matter of using someone else's.
We're not going to get into the car park where it was, but the demeanour of the individual you were talking to, this yep and nope, to be honest, in your telling of it, and you can correct me if I'm wrong here, he sounds kind of pleased with himself. He's almost relishing the confrontation of, you know, he's sticking to his guns and he's showing this busybody woman that he's not going to be put out of that disabled car parking space. He's just going to stay there.
Oh, he was. Absolutely was going to stay there. What was I left to do? Nothing.
And did he seem irritated or did he seem amused or contemptuous? I mean, give us a read on how he looked.
Being honest with you, I wasn't going to look at him because I was scared that there was going to be further confrontation. Like, it's just he was so dismissive of me. I couldn't do any more. I tried to say it politely. I even said when I was leaving him, shame on you. But he didn't care. He was just going to stay there.
And have you ever had a situation where somebody's apologised and said, look, God, really sorry about that. My bad. I'm out of here.
No.
Okay.
No, people don't. They don't take the responsibility if they want to confront you. Mm. There isn't an apology given.
All right. Hang on there, Alison. Hazel. That'd be your experience as well, would it? Good afternoon to you. The apology, it's one you've yet to experience, is it?
I've never experienced it. I am not a shrinking violet. I'm a blue badge holder. I live in a lovely small town in the west, in Westport. And I never pass by somebody parking illegally. I'm a blue badge holder. So I will always say, if you challenge people and say, that's a disabled spot, the usual reply is, I'm only going to be a minute, to which I say, well, that's, you know, I'm sorry for you. I'm going to be disabled forever. But it doesn't, that doesn't, right. It's water off a duck's back. And very commonly...
Oh, sorry, hang on a second. Sorry, Hazel. So they still don't move. They don't go, I'm only going to be a minute, and then proceed to park up. Okay, yeah.
Oh, yeah, they just go ahead and do what they want.
I'm sorry, yeah.
I mean, life is about doing what you want. And the other... I would say 60% of the time it's I'm only going to be a minute, and the other 40% of the time it's F off. Very common.
Really?
Very common. But there's a really simple fix, and you haven't mentioned it yet, and I think nobody in Ireland knows. The fine for improper use of a blue badge space is €150. If that was displayed on the parking space, it would not be abused. When I say to, I have now got this, so if I go to people who are moving in, you know, I will gaze at the windscreen to see if there's a blue badge. And then I will say, do you know it's €150 fine for parking here? They are out of there. They're in gear and gone, like in Formula One start. It works 100% of the time. If it was painted on the blue paint, if there was a sign on, you know, there's a big blue sign, mounted sign on a pole, if it said improper use, €150, nobody would risk it.
It does take enforcement. There has got to be somebody going around, you know, on a sign.
Well, I know, I do. Yeah, well, of course, enforcement is one thing, but a risk of a, whatever, 30, 40 euro fine, it's not enough of a deterrent. I think 150 euro doubling to 240, I think, after 28 days.
Right.
I think that would be, that would make people think twice. And as I say, my experience is that if I say to people, it's 150 euro fine, do you know that? They are gone. They're gone faster than a swallow in September.
But do you not
works
find
every
people?
Time.
Sorry, yeah, Alison, go on.
Yeah, yes, I'm just Alison? Saying, do you not find that in a public area, people, if you said that to people, they will or potentially might move off, but when it's in
no,
a private car park,
no,
you don't.
No,
they,
I've
they
said
don't
that
care.
To people in the local supermarket car parks too, and they're gone. And like you, nobody has ever said, whoops, I'm sorry, I didn't know. And I wouldn't,
no, they
I
don't.
Do think it's really important to be positive about it and not to say, because before I became disabled, it never crossed my mind that it was a need. It's like talking about dark matter. Nobody could imagine, and everybody knows it will never happen to them. We know that.
And Hazel,
so we never have to think about it.
Do you mind me asking, Hazel, sorry, I mean, when you do challenge people, and we've heard Alison saying there that, you know, the disability she has, namely MS, isn't immediately apparent. I mean, what kind of a due diligence do you do on somebody before you challenge them about parking in the space?
If I don't see a blue badge, I challenge.
Okay.
And sometimes the person just has to take it out of the handbag to put it on the dash, and that's fine, and I apologise. I'll say, I'm terribly sorry, I didn't realise. That's great. I'm not a policeman. But I think if it was part of the driver theory test, what's the fine for using a disabled space? If people knew that, if there was a four-week radio campaign or social media campaign saying, did you know this is the fine? People wouldn't abuse it.
Okay,
they'd be taking a huge risk.
Ken McHugh, you agree the fine is effective, do you?
Yeah, it is, yeah. And I caught a guy in a blue zone in Haymarket, just out of Smithfield. He's driving a big SUV. And there's a guard on the corner. He's just a new guard, first guy on duty, actually. And I told him that guy's parked illegally, and he went over and nicked him. And the guy just looked at me, and he took it out of his wallet. He waved his wallet at me.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because he knows a lot of people know that they're being fined, but they can well afford to pay it, yeah.
Oh, so he was prepared. He's playing a percentage game. The number of times he's going to be stopped, you know, parked in a blue space.
Exactly.
He's prepared to play that percentage game to effectively get free, convenient parking. Is that it?
And he could park there all day. Lucky enough, there was a guard on the corner that was able to inform him to go and nick this guy, you know?
Right.
But it happens all the time. Like, what happens when I see them parked in the spot, I take a picture of the license plate and inform the local guard station. And then I send a report into Access Earth. It's accessearth.com, the organisation who's responsible for making sure there's disability access for everybody.
What's Access Ireland, is it?
Pardon?
Access Ireland, is it?
Access Ireland. Yeah. Sorry, Access Earth, EARTH, Access Earth.
Accessearth.com. Okay.
.com.
And you send a report into them with details of the car. And like, what's your strike rate like? Do you know how many times, how many prosecutions you've been involved in? Yeah.
Yeah, right. It's pretty good because I'm in the city centre and it happens all the time in Dublin, yeah.
And you check for a badge, do you?
Yeah, always.
Okay. All right.
Hilda,
good afternoon to you. You're in the Midlands.
Hiya, how are you? Yeah,
You were listening to Alison there.
I was. I have MS as well, so it's not a visible disability that I have. I do have the blue badge. And you know, I am sick to the back teeth of getting filthy looks every time I park in a disabled parking space. The hostility of people, because, inverted commas, I look fine. You know, it's just, I've had women stand in front of the disabled space waving no, no to me.
All right.
I've had one person come up to me and say, well, you don't look disabled.
It's so intimidating. It is so intimidating to get out there.
It's horrible. It is. It's horrible. It's horrible. Now, I would, again, like that, I'd be looking for the first place when I go to do my shopping. Most of the cars will be displaying a blue badge. But if there's a car park that isn't, and there's a certain shop that I would go to in Port Leash, and there will always be somebody in at least two places who are disabled, because I know them, or I know of them, and they'll just sit there parking. I went up one time to ask them, sorry, do you have a blue badge? I'm looking for a space. I got told where to go, where I could stick my blue badge. But I just don't bother approaching people anymore.
Right.
I can't be dealing with the vitriol people have.
And do you think, you know, I mean, you've heard, you know, Hazel does ask people if they're entitled to be parking there, and, you know, probably the people who are prepared to show her the blue badge know where she's coming from. But do you think there's another category of people who maybe it doesn't come from a place of civic mindedness, you know, where they're challenging you because they like challenging people?
They just don't care, Colin. They just do not care. If the parking space that's close beside the door, you know, and if it's free, they're just going to rock up and take it. Simple as.
I mean, but the people who are challenging you, who are giving you grief about not having an obvious disability, I mean, do you think they have the welfare of people with a disability in mind when they go about challenging people, or do you think they just get off on challenging people?
I think they just get off on challenging. I really do. I can't wrap my head around it, how people would be like that. You know, and I understand, MS is an invisible disability. And, you know, I do look normal, for want of a better term. But I need my blue badge. I need that space. And people just have...
Would you mind if somebody asked you, like, you know, like Hazel was saying, if somebody said, you know, excuse me, do you have a blue badge? If it was done in a non-confrontational way, would you mind being asked? Or are you just browned off at this stage? You've been asked at all?
No, my blue badge is displayed at all times in my windshield in front of me, and there for everybody to see. And if somebody was to come up and approach me nicely, I'd say, yeah, there it is there. You know, no bother, that's fine. But it's the abusive mentality that people have.
All right, Paul. This sounds familiar to you. Does it have been challenged in the car park?
Yes, it certainly does, Colin. Yes, my wife and I were we parked in a supermarket car park here in Galway City, and we got out of the car, went into the supermarket, and I was just inside the door when this guy tipped me on the shoulder, and he says, I observed you getting out of the parking in the park in the disabled parking space, and neither of you, to me, looks like you have any medical problems. So why are you parked here?
Was he a doctor?
And well, I'm getting to that now. I was stuck to the ground. I was stuck to the ground, and so was my wife. And he turned on his heel and went back out the door again. And it was only when he was gone out that it registered with me what he had said. So I chased him out, and I caught up with him. And I says to him, I says, are you a doctor? And he said, no. Well, I says, how can you diagnose people's medical problems? I says, if you're not. I says, come back to me when you're qualified, I says. So I just left it at that.
And again, your wife is in a position, she didn't have a disability that was apparent to him, but, you know, what was the nature of the confrontation? How did he approach you? Was it in a kind of a belligerent way, or, you know, a polite way?
Oh, yes. Incidentally, my wife was just back from Beaumont. She was after having a kidney transplant, among a lot of other medical issues.
Right.
So she was just after a kidney transplant, and... He was very, very authority looking, driven, you know, and very stern about what he was saying, you know.
Right. Did you get a shock?
So, I did get a shock. Sure, he was going out the door before I realised what he had said, and that's why I chased him out again, you know. And he strikes me as being some kind of a guy that spends the day walking around car parks looking for something like that, you know. That's how he spends his time, you know.
All right. Well, maybe
so
he could
get a shot.
Maybe he could be found useful employment policing blue badge spaces. He could make a career out of it.
Exactly. Instead of the opposite, you know. Exactly. But it is a big problem all over the country. People without badges parking in disabled areas.
You've experienced that as well, is it?
Look at I was up in the hospital with my wife the other day, and now there's a lot of disabled spaces up there. But there's one with 9 disabled spaces. 3 of them had cars with no badges. And I was driving around for ages and ages, and she had an appointment there before I had to go into the main car park in the end because I couldn't get a disabled space. So that's how bad it is.
All right, well, that's people...
But there's nobody policing it in supermarket car parks or private car parks. There's nobody policing it, you know.
All right, Paul, Alison, Hazel, Ken, thanks a million for calling. You know where we are. If you have experience of this, people parking in the car parking space, or if your disability is of a nature where people may not be able to immediately recognise it and you've been challenged in the wrong, 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps, 51551 for your texts, and liveline at rte.ie for your emails. Back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, 0818-715-815.
Now, how many hours, or it probably seems like days, are you spending in the bus or the train or the car on your way back and forth from third level if you haven't been able to secure accommodation in close proximity to your college? 087-484-8888 for your WhatsApps on that, 51551 for your text. Franek Dobronski, how are you?
Hello, how are you?
Good. What time of the day do you generally get started at?
So it varies, but most days I'm usually starting around 5 a.m, especially on Mondays and Thursdays this semester, because that's how my lectures align.
All right. And you're starting from where?
So I get up at 5 a.m. every day, well, those days specifically in Carlow, where I'm from. And I take the train up to Dublin, Houston. And from there, I take around 2 buses up to the Drumcondra campus in DCU. So I probably do that on a daily basis, pretty much.
Okay, and so that's to land there if you have a 9 o'clock lecture, is it?
Yes, specifically if I have a 9 a.m. lecture, that's when I get up at 5 a.m. But since today I started lectures at around, I think it was 12, so I didn't have to get up at 5 a.m. thankfully. But yeah, I do get up a bit later, but it is always early morning wake-ups.
Okay. And what are you studying?
I'm studying a bachelor's in climate and environmental sustainability in Dublin City University.
Okay, and have you kind of a busy day with lectures and tutorials and the like? What time do you normally wrap up at?
This semester I wrap up around 3 p.m. and if the starting times vary, obviously on the day. So a few of them, like I mentioned, some of them might start at 10 or 12, but I usually wrap up at around 3 p.m. so I can get home before 6. But if I have, let's say, for example, some society activities. Or I'm very almost on the university rowing team, so I have trainings in the evenings, depending on the schedule. So right. I do stay up in Dublin way longer, so it doesn't really vary on the day.
Right, and, you know, rowing, I think anyone who's ever done it, it takes it out of you. It's one of those forms of exercises that you feel the burn fairly early on when you start the training. So are you back from DCU into, is it Island Bridge to do that?
Yes, I'm in Island Bridge. So I commute, obviously, from Dublin City University if there's training down to Island Bridge to train. I train with Neptune Rowing Club over there. So that does, yeah, like you mentioned yourself, it does take me out of it. Like with this semester, and especially, we're just getting started, so we don't know our training schedule yet. But I would probably say it might be late evening trainings or on the occasional early morning trainings. If that happens, I have to crash out of my mate's place, you know.
All right, the option isn't there to get home to Carlow if you have late evening training on the Liffey at Island Bridge.
No, wouldn't be now, yeah.
Yeah. But generally speaking, you're talking about, you know, the up at 5 a.m. and you're 2 hours on the road, is it, by the time you get out to DCU, if you're lucky, I presume, because it's...
Yeah, something like that around. Yeah, the train journey itself is around an hour. I'm lucky enough to live around 10 minutes away from the train station in Carlow Town. So it's like probably, yeah, like I said, an hour. And then depending on, obviously, Dublin traffic and rush hour, which varies from day to day, that could be another hour or close to an hour and a half, so... On a lucky enough day, it's around 2 hours, but yeah, it does really vary. It's really dependent on the day.
And, you know, you're involved in clubs and societies, which is part of, you know, life in college, but there's the study bit as well and revision and coursework and all of that. So where do you fit that in?
Well, I'm lucky enough that I have Tuesdays off this semester. So I can go back home and obviously home I might study and do my bit of work there. But I have some lectures where I have like a few hour gap in between, so I can squeeze in a few hours of study or doing assignments if I have to. But also, because I'm commuting as well, that means for most of the day I'm busy with other stuff. So I probably will be fitting in a lot of study time on the weekends as well. So it's just we've got to work around the schedule and just change a few things up a bit because I'm a commuting student.
So if you hit the road immediately after your latest lecture at 3 o'clock and go straight to Houston Station, because the traffic may not have built up much at that stage, but you're probably still hitting school traffic, you're getting home around the 6 mark. If you leave it any later, I mean, what's the latest you're getting in the evening?
Well, so for example, on Monday I took the 6:35 service home. So I was home like probably at around 8-ish, something like that. So that's just averaging. We're making general assumptions. So around 8 on average, and during the week, I'd be coming back home. But like you said yourself, if I was to leave after 3 p.m., I would probably be home at around 6 or 6:30-ish, if I was to assume.
And what are your late travel options then, if there was, you know, a social event or anything on, or are you just out of options at that stage? Are you back to crashing on a friend's couch?
Well, to be honest, I'm lucky enough that I have a few options. So obviously, like I said, I usually might take the 6:35 service in the evening to get back to Carlow. But the latest service down to Waterford Line is the 8:21, if I'm correct. So that's my latest option by train. And if I want to take a coach back home, I have the 9:20 service, just making sure I'm not making any mistakes with the numbers. By J.J. Kavanagh, and they leave from Houston Station. So that's probably my latest option if I was to choose to commute back home. But if I don't, aside from that, I would have to obviously crash at a mate's place. Right. But I did look at a bus from J.J. Kavanagh, and they have one running from Houston Station at 1 a.m., which is really late. And I hope I never have to take that one. But in that case, I would probably have to crash at a mate's place. Or if some of my course mates or my friends from like other stuff might say, hey, let's go out, or, you know, we haven't been downtown in a while, then I'd probably have to ask one of them, can I sleep on their couch or, you know, crash for the day?
Right. I mean, look, this comes down to the expense of accommodation. I mean, you're in second year now, you're doing the commute, but you have lived up before. And I mean, what's the cost difference between being a commuter and accommodation?
The costs are very, very different. So apologies for the background noise.
Fire away.
The prices are very different. For example, I'm pretty sure the estimate I got when I was doing the interview with Irish Times was around 200 a month for all the commuting expenses, like combining train tickets, the leap card tap-ins, or, you know, maybe the occasional bus journey. So that equates around 200-ish euro, I'd say.
A month.
A month. And in DCU, the on-campus student accommodation was around 800 a month, which I would like to likely say is actually cheaper in retrospect and, you know, in comparison to private accommodation, which tends to exceed 1,000 euros. So as a commuter student, I am saving a lot of money in that sense, yes.
Right. And do you have time for a part-time job at all? Or
I'm a seasonal worker, so I was working over the summer. So I've saved up a bit of my pocket. So I'm lucky that I don't have to work during the academic year.
And with all you have on, how are the energy levels by comparison to last year? Because you can compare directly what it's like to live up and do all you're doing on campus and, you know, do all you're doing now and have at least a 4-hour commute in your day. I mean, it's early days, but do you think this is sustainable for the, what is it, three years left in college?
Yeah, it's 3 years in distance. I'd like to say it is. I mentioned earlier that I feel like I'm in a very doable or commutable distance. I know it's obviously, it is a large amount of hours spent commuting and traveling. But if I was to, per se, living in like Tipperary or Kilkenny or any county further away from Dublin, I would probably by then be looking for accommodation, whether it be private or some other form. But in a sustainable sense, like you're asking, I think this is a doable commute for me. I've obviously found a way to balance my studies, like I mentioned, in some way, or at least I have a plan. And additionally, I'm also, you know, involved in clubs and socks in the university as well. And I have some other stuff happening in my life. Nice. So I think based on the plan I've made, I think it is a sustainable thing. I'm obviously just getting used to it because it's my first week back in college. But yeah, I'd say this is a sustainable form, in my opinion.
Well, don't fall out with those mates on whose couches you're crashing anyway. That's a that's, I suppose, something you have to be guided by as well. You need a few safe houses around the city if you're going to be staying up. Franek, thanks a million for talking to us.
Thanks for having me. I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right, not a worry. Best of luck with the course. Hope it goes well for you, and fair play for all the sustainable transport. It's very much in keeping with your course of study, and best of luck with the rowing as well.
Thank you very much.
All right. All right, have a listen to the... You may be familiar with the phenomenon that is the musical Hamilton. Have a listen to this bit of it.
Alexander, come back to sleep.
I have an early meeting out of town.
It's still dark outside.
I know. I just need to write now, something down.
Why do you write like you're running out of
Alexander
time?
Hamilton, come the man after whom the musical is named, is talking to his wife. His wife is begging him not to go and engage in the duel with Aaron Burr. This is one of the set pieces of American history, a sliding doors moment of what might have happened. It's part of the dramatic tension of the musical phenomenon that is Hamilton. Zoe Coyle, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, thanks for having me.
You are very familiar with that piece of music, it would be safe to say at this stage, wouldn't it?
I am, yes.
It's the soundtrack to a video you made. Tell us about what is it? What's your point of connection with that particular dramatic scene and how you decided to do it a little bit differently?
So if you listen to the soundtrack before you ever watch the musical, I was listening to the songs on shuffle. So I heard that song directly after the song Say No to This, which is where he cheats on his wife. So my thinking hearing that was, okay, he's obviously sneaking off to cheat on his wife. And then I actually watched the musical and I was like, oh, he's not, he's going to engage in a duel. So I thought, it's funny that I thought of it like that. So I thought, like, I'm going to share this to people and portray that.
Right. Well, and look, once a love rat, always a love rat. It was probably a fair assumption to make about him. So you thought, this is the love rat getting out the window to meet the lover. And so you got dressed up and acted the part. Where did you act it out?
I acted it out in my grandmother's house, on her window.
Now, when you say on her window, tell us exactly what you were doing and how you were dressed.
I had a long brown coat, and I had tissue paper stuffed into my neck to make the old-timey kind of collar, I don't know what to call it.
Yeah, the kind of ruffle on the front of the shirt like they would have had in the 18th century. It's very convincing because I was asking the team here, where did she get the ruffle shirt? I was wondering, did you hire it for the occasion? But anyway, you've revealed the secret now. It's homemade with tissue paper.
Yeah, and I had a beard drawn on my face with mascara, and I also had a hairpin in my hair hanging down off my forehead to represent the wig mic they use on Broadway.
And a very convincing beard it is too. So you're there at the window in your grandmother's house. What time of the day or night is it when you recorded this?
It's roughly 2:30 in the morning.
Right. And it's been filmed from outside the window. Who's filming it?
Nobody's filming it. I set the camera up on my bed with a bunch of books and stuff to hold it up. I set the 10-second timer and I jumped up on the window.
All right, fair play to you. So anyway, you recorded this at 2:30 in the morning, and what, you took out the makeup remover, removed the tissue from your shirt and got back into bed, did you?
Yeah, I posted the video and then I took off the beard and stuff and I went to sleep.
And thought no more about it?
Yeah.
And you don't have notifications on TikTok, which, you know, for anyone who's not familiar with it, means that the reaction to your video is not being pinged into your phone. So when did you first discover that there was a bit of movement on the old video?
I woke up the next morning, just kind of in the afternoon, because I was up late the night before, obviously. And I opened TikTok to see thousands of notifications, and I was just like, what is going on? And I checked it, and there were so many people liking and sharing and commenting on that video, and I was actually just in shock.
Right. And not just anyone. It kind of gathered legs.
Yeah.
Well, go on, tell us, who saw it? Who shocked you most by commenting on it?
The actual Hamilton official account commented on it. There was the actual TikTok official account.
This is the official TikTok account for promoting the licensed musical Hamilton that tours all over the world. This is their main social media promotion tool. They saw your video, even though you were basically accusing Alexander Hamilton of running off to see another woman instead of going to a duel. But notwithstanding all of that, they liked your work.
They did, and they commented on it. And eventually, once the trend had kind of taken off and lots of people were doing it, they made a compilation of a bunch of people doing it and they posted it on their own page.
And when you say once the trend had taken off, in other words, people had not only seen and liked your work, but there was a rash of people copying it.
Yeah, and not just like normal people. There was hundreds of people recreating it, and then there was also like influencers and brands recreating it.
And people doing their own twist on it. They weren't just getting out windows this time. What other exits and entrances were they using?
I've seen people do it on like a canoe in a lake. I've seen people do like on a horse or going out the dog door of a house.
Out the dog flap in the door of a house, the lower dog flap, right, squeezing through it.
Yeah.
So give us the viewing viewing figures on it now. How many times has it been viewed and liked and the like now?
The last I checked, it had roughly 11 million, almost 12 million views, and it has 1.9 million likes.
Is it still going? Are people still making them?
It is still going. Every day I get notifications saying this person commented, and I'm like, guys, this was 2 months ago.
I suppose the question to ask is now, when did you tell your granny?
Well, I wasn't going to tell her in the first place because I thought there was no point. Like, it was just TikTok, and I thought she'd get mad at me for stealing her jacket and going out the window at that time of night.
Oh, it was her jacket, was it? Because for anyone who hasn't seen the video, it's a kind of a suede. A light suede jacket, long kind of a three-quarter length one. Very stylish granny, it has to be said.
Oh yeah, she's very stylish. But that's her coat, the famous coat.
And she wouldn't like to see it disappearing out the window at 2:30 in the morning.
No, and a lot of people said to me that I looked really nervous in the video, and that's because I actually was. My nana has 6 dogs in her house, and they're all out in the garden barking at me while I was going out the window.
Right. You could reenact it with your granny. She could play Hamilton's wife. You could play Hamilton. You could do the whole thing all over again, and she'd probably look like she was playing it for real too, because she wouldn't want to see her coat going out the window.
I'll ask her.
And you could, anyway, bring in the dogs in at that stage. Maybe you could get them through a few dog flaps. You might have trouble putting beards on them, though.
Well, some of the dogs have featured in some of my other videos. So I think they've had their 5 minutes of fame.
Right. Okay. But none as significant as this. But anyway, the Hamilton official TikTok account not only gotten, you know, liked it, included in a compilation, but they direct messaged you as well, did they?
Yeah, they did. They reached out to me and they said that they'd like to extend an invite to the premiere of the filmed version of the Hamilton film in honour of their 10-year anniversary.
So, of course, you said, no, I'm busy that night, did you?
You know what? I actually thought that this was like a pipe dream and that no one was just going to drop everything and take me to New York. So I went and I was like all sad. But then like people actually worked together and I got there and it was actually just like the best day of my life.
You went, did you?
I did, yes.
Who did you go along with?
Wednesday. I went with my dad.
He was probably delighted of an excuse to go to New York, was he?
Oh, yeah, he was.
And what happened on the red carpet? You went along to the premiere and, you know, did you didn't have to wear the brown coat and the mascara beard with the tissue ruffle in your shirt, did you?
I actually did.
Good woman.
They emailed before it and they said, would you mind bringing along your costume? We're encouraging people to wear the costume and we're going to make some content. So we arrived there and we got photos taken on the carpet. And then a few of us changed into the Hamilton outfits and we made some content for like the Hamilton account and the Disney account.
And did you have to be climbing out a window for people to recognise you?
You know what? They actually brought a window to the red carpet. They had like a prop window with curtains and everything. And they got videos of some of us and some of the cast going out the window.
And you reenacted it all over again with some of the cast?
Yeah, a few of the cast stood beside the window and they made a video to that song with us.
And what did they? Did you get talking to any of the cast? What did they say to you?
I got to speak to Oak, which is the actor who plays Hercules Mulligan. I met him at the intermission in the theatre, and he was actually really nice. I had a brief interaction with Lin-Manuel Miranda. I went up to him, I shook his hand, and I said hello. But there wasn't actually much time to speak with the cast, unfortunately.
Right. So that's it. You're going to continue making these TikTok videos, are you?
I am, of course. I just ordered an actual Hamilton outfit to level my videos up a bit.
Fair enough. You got to upgrade. Granny's not going to give you that coat forever, is she?
Well, she said I can keep it.
Okay. Will you be taking her up on that?
I think I'll have to.
Okay. Well, look, best of luck. We look forward to seeing more of you, the six dogs, the granny's coat on a window on a red on another red carpet sometime soon. But Zoe Coyle, thanks very much for chatting to us.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
Not a worry. All right. We're back in a minute.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Now, today, 10th of September, is World Suicide Prevention Day. We're conscious today that there are many people grieving in the aftermath of suicides in their family. And there are people today who are prepared to talk about this, because changing the narrative on suicide is the theme for today's International Awareness Day. That's the theme for the International Awareness Day in 2025. It's calling on people and communities and organisations and governments to foster open and honest conversations about suicide, and maybe by talking about it, people who are dealing with the pain of this can get to talk to each other. It raises people's awareness of it, and maybe raises some of the awareness of what could be done to maybe intervene with a loved one who is suffering with whatever they're suffering with, because we don't know what drives people to complete a suicide. All we know is that there is awful pain and grief left behind. Julie Pettit, good afternoon to you.
Hello, Colin. How are you?
Thanks very much for coming on.
Yes, good to talk to you.
And how are you doing today?
I'm okay. I'm. I suppose I wasn't expecting to be here, really, when I heard yesterday that you were asking people to come on to talk about grief and how they cope with grief. And I happened to be sitting at the laptop, and I sent off an email because I thought I know something about that, you know. And I suppose it's a common misconception, Colin, that, you know, you'll get through grief or you'll get over grief. But that's not the case, you know, at all. It's 8 years since I lost my son Jack to suicide, and you know, I suppose at the stage I'm at now, I can say that what does happen is that you do try and find a way to live with it, you know, and it is possible. The main thing is that you keep hope in your heart that someday you will find a way to live with it, because when it happens at the start, it is so utterly devastating for the family, for extended family, for friends. You think you won't survive it. You know, that's. I remember feeling that at the time when Jack died, that I wouldn't survive this, but 8 years on, I can say that I have, and I do, and I live a life now that where I've realised that grief and joy and life again can coexist.
But as you say, not easily. Are you okay to tell us a little bit about Jack? What kind of a guy was he?
He was a great guy. He was a great guy. He was 20. He was a big, strong chap. He was much loved within our immediate family. He was a much loved cousin, nephew, grandson, and a great friend. He was very sporty, very successful at sport from a very early age, and that was a big part of his life growing up. And he was a good chap, you know. He lived a normal life. We just We lived a normal life.
Until you didn't. And this was an awful trauma to be visited on you.
Yeah, that's right. Until we didn't. I suppose I think of it quite often as before and after, you know. He died on the 24th of July, 2017. And it was completely and utterly out of the blue. You know, we had no idea. We had no expectation. We never imagined that that this would happen, that we would find ourselves in this position, you know, and you're catapulted into this this new club of, you know, in my case, a bereaved parent, and you can't get out of this club. You're in it, you know, and the effects of it are so far-reaching, you know, through the family, through the friends, through the extended family, through the community, and through all that he was connected with, you know, because he made such an impression on people throughout his 20 years that, you know, it impacted a lot of people when he died.
Obviously, you know, his mom and dad and his brother being the people who were most affected by it, and as you say, the wider family and the friends as well. And for anybody listening to this, you know, if you have been similarly affected, rte.ie/helplines is the contact detail we normally give out for people to access support services and the like. But on that exact point, Julie, I mean, what helped you? You are here 8 years later. What helped you get through that? Were people able to talk to you about Jack? Did people avoid the subject? Did you join a group that was a safe space? What worked for you?
No, I suppose initially, Colm, you know, when I think back, like that first week, say, like that's you know, they say it takes a child, takes a village to raise a child. It also takes that village to bury a child, and that army of people that came in initially that first week and just took over and did everything that had to be done around the funeral time. And then you wake up and, you know, the morning after the funeral, and you think, you know, how are we going to survive this? How am I going to survive this? And I suppose very clearly I can think back to that morning, knowing that I had, you know, we had a younger son. And you don't have a choice. You have to get up, you know, you have to get up and go. And you take it initially hour by hour, and gradually then you take it day by day. And that first year is you're still busy with your child, with the child that has died. You're busy with inquest and, you know, funeral first and then inquest and getting through those firsts of Christmas and birthdays and memorial cards and first anniversary. So you're still busy with all of that stuff for that child that has died. And you go past that first anniversary, and that second year, I'm sure I'm not alone in how I felt about that. It's worse almost, because you've nothing else to do then, you know, for that child. Your work is done effectively. So that's a really difficult year to head into. And I suppose, you know, you think you won't find the strength. Like if you'd have asked me 10 years ago, or if you'd have told me 10 years ago that this would happen, I would think, well, I won't survive that. I wouldn't be able to live on. But you do. I don't know where it comes from. It's a combination, I suppose, of inner strength and the sheer kindness of people. And the quiet and gentle support that good people will provide, you know, they stay with you and they'll keep in touch. You mightn't always be able to respond, but they'll keep coming and keep coming. And I suppose if I was to say to anybody who's trying to support someone that is bereaved through suicide, is that you can't fix it. You can't change it. All you can do, I would have found the best thing is just stand quietly by. Yes, give the practical help, bring the dinner, do the shopping, that kind of stuff. But stand quietly by as well for that bereaved person to come back to themselves a little bit. But it's a long process. It's you know, and that I'm talking 3 or 4 years maybe that you will have to stand quietly by.
And obviously, it's a tragedy like no other, because you're probably looking back at what were the signs, what could we have done? You know, he was our child. Could we have protected him? I mean, there must be an awful lot of doubt that comes with that. You're concentrating then on the remaining child. Does it shake your confidence about how you are as a parent with the remaining child?
It shatters your confidence. It shatters everything. But it shatters your confidence as a parent. And you have to rebuild all of that. And you do, yes, you look back, you know, those first 3 or 4 years, you look back constantly to say, where did I go wrong? What did I miss? What could I have done? And that guilt is there for a long time. There's a lot of emotion tied up in it. There are so many different emotions. There's anger at the world because it kept going. There's resentment. There's envy of other family and friends whose life, you know, their solid normal path. It's really hard not to let that eat at you, because those emotions can destroy you or stop you healing. So to me now, when I look back, that's all a very normal and natural reaction. But it does take work not to let it bring you down and keep you down, you know, so that you can try and move forward.
And your partner or your husband in this case, Liam, I mean, they're your life partners, you know, it's your child. The only other person you would normally talk to in a crisis like this would be your spouse, who's grieving probably at a different pace, in a different way. It's very hard, is it, to be there for each other as completely as you might need?
That's right. It's extremely difficult, because people do grieve differently at different times, at different stages. And it does put a lot of strain, you know, on a marriage, on all relationships, actually. And all you can do is try and support each other. But it's so, the pain and the sense of loss is so consuming, you know, as well. So you're not just on your own. You have these other people in your family that are all struggling and suffering as well. So, you know, the effects of life for a family after somebody is lost to suicide they're vast.
And how important are other people, you know, and talking to other people? How important is that in trying to at least achieve some sense of compassion for yourself about all of those difficult feelings and the anger and the envy and all of the things you talked about, and the guilt and the doubt and everything else, connections and relationships?
I remember at 6 weeks, I thought I was actually going mad with pain. And I did go to see a counsellor at that time, because I just need one question answered. I just needed that person to say to me, you're not going mad. This is normal. And that's all I was able for at that time. At 18 months, I needed another question answered. And again, I went to one session. And again, that's all I needed or was able for at that time. You know, people would have said so regularly to us over the years, you must go to counselling, you should go to counselling. I'm not a big advocate of that, you know. I think that can work very well for people if they're ready for it, if they're, you know, if they're able for it as well. If you have a friend, if you have somebody close to you that you can talk to, that will help as well. There are a number of other things that you can do. I suppose, you know, Colin, the counselling doesn't make the pain go away. That's a big factor of it, you know. It's not going to take away, it's not going to change things. And yes, certainly it can, if you're really, really, really struggling to move forward, it can help you certainly to find that way, at that time.
Now, look, you rang in because we talked to Nicola Pierce yesterday, who lost her husband, Niall, to cancer. And, you know, you contacted us to talk about grief, but it is suicide prevention day to day. And there are other people, whatever struggles Jack had that he didn't communicate to you, there are other people out there in a similar bind dealing with whatever feelings or emotions or thoughts they're dealing with there. I mean, if you could talk to somebody in the same predicament out there today, what would you say to them?
I'd say talk to somebody. Talk to somebody, talk to a friend or a teacher or your doctor or somebody in your family or a counsellor. It doesn't have to be a sit-down face-to-face counsellor. It can be somebody at the end of the phone. Just talk to somebody because, you know, we can all be so much stronger than we think we can, and just to take that step. And I have no idea, you know, I know I have known the very darkest of days, but I still have no idea of what it's like for that person to be in that very, very, very dark spot. I just know that if they just can take that step, that there are brighter days ahead. There are always brighter days ahead. Because the pain and the loss left behind for those who lose people to suicide it's immeasurable. It's immeasurable. And you do take a piece of them with you as well, you know. So if you can just think of one person, that you can reach out to help you, well, that's the first step. You know, the pain of suicide is really, really, really tough. And you are right. It's you know, there are different stages of grief. There are different levels of grief. You know, I lost my mom 3 years ago.
I'm sorry to hear that.
And that's, you know, that mom had a great life. She was 92. That was a very sad. And I grieved, of course, when mom died. And I still grieve for her. But it's a different kind of grief to losing a child. And there are further complications to it when that child is lost by suicide. You know, that's... So it's not the same all across the board. Grief is not the same. And that's not to negate anybody else's grief from losing a family member. Mm. But it is different. It is different.
Julie, you've been very generous talking to us today about that. I know it's not easy. And as you say yourself, the 8 years, the pain is still there and it doesn't go away. But I hope you're as well as can be expected today after talking to us about that.
Yeah, thank you, Colin. We are well. We're doing okay. You know, you can have a fulfilling life. You can feel joy again. You know, you can sing again. You'll dance again. I know I probably wouldn't have been able to take that on board if I heard somebody saying it 2 years ago or a year ago. But. You know, there are a number of things. It takes time. I'd like to come on today and say, well, actually, it gets easier. It doesn't get easier, but time does help. Time does. It just helps you come back to yourself a bit. It helps you to process things a bit more. Time does actually help.
Well, I'm sure there's people listening, sending love to you and Liam and Jack's surviving brother. So thanks for joining us today. And if anyone wants to have that conversation or contact services, rte.ie/helplines for that. We're going to take a quick break. Back in a minute. Mick Matthews, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Colin. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
I'm okay today. I'm doing all right. Working away, doing a bit of training. So, yeah, no, I'm fine. Okay. I'm all good, yeah.
You heard, I don't know whether you heard Julie there before the break.
I did.
She was talking about Jack. You lost Philip a bit longer ago, 14 years ago. Jack died 8 years ago. 14 years ago, you lost Philip. I'm sure you can identify with Julie there. It probably didn't get any easier for you either.
No, I think it's I remember years ago when I was a young man, somebody talking to my father about, you know, somebody's son died. I can't remember.
Mick, your line is just a bit scratchy, so we're going to try and get you up again. We're going to try take a quick break and see if we can get you up on the line again. Just bear with us. Mick Matthews, we have you back, I think, on a better line.
Colm, I hope so. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah, I can, loud and clear. And thanks for bearing with us.
My mother used to always say, there's a bird on the wire.
So tell us, Mick, about Philip.
Philip was the middle of my three boys. Lovely fella. He was the fun lad. He was always up to some devilments, always was as a kid. But a happy chap, always in good humour, smiling and laughing, good sportsman. And he was in his last year as apprentice as a plumber. And, you know, as I said, everything seemed to be happy and rosy in the garden. And unfortunately, that's all of a sudden you get this, and it's the death happens, and it's like your world just changes. The earth opens up and swallows you, and you don't know what to do or think or say, because this is not right. This shouldn't be happening. You can go through, I said, the emotions are a killer, because you get so many of them, and a lot of them come at the same time together, and that can be very hard to deal with. Yeah.
And you probably heard some of what Julie was telling us before we came on. What kind of you know, emotions are you talking about, even when people, you know, ask you about your family, people who don't know you?
Well, it's. I think the thing is that you're. I remember somebody calling to my house a couple of weeks after the funeral and saying to me, "How's the impersonation?" And I didn't know what they were talking about. I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Do you find people are looking at you when you go down to town?" And I said, "I've only been down twice in 3 weeks because I didn't want to go out." Mm. And that's, you know, that's not me. But there was sadness, remorse, guilt, anger, shame. Like you can terror afraid of something. What happens to my other two boys?
And why shame, Mick?
You know. Well, it's what kind of a bloody parent are you? You know, excuse me, French. Look, why did you not look after your son? And it's like that's like a reflection on yourself. Did I not do what I should have done? That would have occurred to me with all the other emotions over a long period of time, until I finally found a way of parking the emotions as best I could. They never completely go away. They're always there.
Right. But when you're talking about, you know, those kind of negative thoughts coming in on you, is there, you know, a critical voice that comes up when you're dealing with all of these strong emotions that's articulating these things to you as you rake over the coals?
Yeah, I think it's probably your own self-doubt. If you doubt yourself when something like this happens, as you say, you think about everything you've done, everything I've done in my life up to then. Was I missing something? Why wasn't I looking after my sons? You know, and how were the other two? And what happened? The biggest thing was probably just the why. I spent 2 years trying to figure out why did it happen? Why didn't I do something? Why wasn't somebody listening to him, talking to him? And it took me a long time, probably 2 years or more, to realise that there isn't an answer to why, because you never know.
And where did you find the strength to set up Skerry's Youth Support Services? I mean, where did that come from? I made all of this.
That came, that's 10 years on the go now. That came from talking to people, because I opened up to people. At first I didn't, but then I started to open up and talk to people. And I told them, like, straight away, you know, I used to be worried the time somebody would ask you, how many kids have you got? And I'd say, well, I tell them I have two or three, because if they ask me where they are, it's very hard to say, well, one of them's actually in the graveyard. But at the end of the day, you can't deny, that would be denying your son.
But you felt it would just be too much for people. Some people might not want a conversation the topic of suicide in it.
You didn't want to throw that on top of people, but I came around the fact that, I'm sorry, well, that's reality, that's where it's at, and I'm not going to deny my son. That's the reality of where I live. I have lost a child. And I was able to talk to people. That was probably the biggest thing. I opened up to people and told them how I was feeling. I think it's that Maeve Binchy's phrase, isn't it? How are you? That's a question, not a greeting. Mm. I was an open book. And because of that, people knew me and came to me and talked about their kids, and they were worried about them. So we started Scariest Youth Support Services to try and... literally, we started putting the booklet out that gave all the organisations that were there to help young people, and put them all in a book, and we put 15,000 out over 2 years, all funded by local people. But gradually realised that there was a huge problem with people getting counselling. So that's why Scariest Youth Support Services started counselling about 8 years ago. And we're now doing between 3 and 4 days a week of free counselling, which we fund through local events, organisations, or the North Fingal area. And it's difficult, you know, we have to pay 8,000 quid a year just for a room to give free counselling, which seems daft, but that's the world we live in. But it's such an important part of our community now, that whole North Fingal, Rush Lusk, all that area, that people, we get people, we had people actually recently sent by a very well-known other big organisation down to us, because our waiting list was shorter than anybody else's.
Right.
So, but I think it's early intervention counselling for young people, hopefully to get them back on track when they fall off the wagon, rather than wait till they crash the wagon, you know.
All right. And
that's
RTE.ie
/helplines
if you do want to contact any of the organisations for some of those early interventions that Mick talked about. And thanks for joining us, Mick, and indeed fair play to you for setting up the youth support services in the middle of all that grief. That's unfortunately our lot for today. The